Hi guys, and welcome back to another True Crime in Makeup Time video. Today's case was a request by Buckley's Chance 3267. So thank you so much for requesting this case. I was so young when this tragedy took place, but I remember my mom's reaction to the news so clearly about this missing boy. So this case is pretty sickening. It will make you sick to your stomach. So watch with caution. A young boy with a promising future snatched away by an act of unspeakable violence. His story broke the hearts of not only Australians, but it resonated around the world. Let's get into it and talk about the tragic case of Daniel Morcombe. Daniel James Morcombe was born on December 19, 1989 in Melbourne, Australia, to his parents Bruce and Denise Morcombe. He had two brothers, Dean and Bradley, and Bradley was actually his twin brother, and they were extremely close. They grew up in a really loving home, first in Darwin, and then they moved to Queensland, the Sunshine Coast, and they lived in the town of Palmwood. Over here, they lived in a small rural property, and his parents were actually successful franchisers of Jim's Trees, which was a business for tree pruning and removal. And if any of you guys are Australians, how many of you have seen Jim's everything everywhere? You know, those trucks. So it's crazy that it's been around for that long, but his parents would essentially sell franchises of Jim's Trees in the area of Queensland, and they were responsible for advertising and just generating work for the franchisees. From an early age, Daniel had a bright and curious personality. He loved the outdoors, outdoor activities like motocross. He loved animals. And because of this, his parents filled the family home with many pets, including a pony that Daniel adored. Neighbors knew him as a quiet and helpful child, and he would actually help pick fruit around the neighbors' homes when it was harvest time. So the family actually moved to Queensland in 1993 when Daniel and his brothers were really young, and Daniel attended Siena Catholic College. His teachers and friends described Daniel as a hardworking, polite student. He excelled academically. He participated in community events, sports events. And although he was quiet, he had a close circle of friends and was known for his kindness and integrity. And he was the kind of kid who never really caused any trouble. So fast forward to December 7th, 2003. Daniel is now 13 years old, and him and his brothers woke up early that day to help their neighbors pick passion fruit in exchange for some pocket money. So they had actually been doing this for a while, helping their neighbors, the Paxtons, pick passion fruit on their farm. That day in particular, they were due to help them at about 6:30 a.m. And after they finished helping the Paxtons, they were due to travel to Mansfield in Brisbane for a work Christmas picnic. So his parents, Bruce and Denise, were organizing this Christmas work family picnic for all the franchisees. So that morning, the family, they all had breakfast together before starting their plans for the day. So that morning, it actually began to rain quite heavily. So the Paxtons phoned the boys and they were like, hey, can you come at 7:30 instead of 6:30? Let the rain die down. And then because of this, his parents, Bruce and Denise, decided to actually head on to Mansfield by themselves and leave the boys at home. And the reason for this is because Brisbane was about a 1.5-hour drive away from their house, and they wanted to make sure they got to the park in time so that they could set up everything, because the picnic was going to be running from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. And they just wanted to make sure they had everything ready and got a good spot. So that's why they left the boys at home and went without them. But the boys didn't mind. They were happy to stay at home that day. So the three brothers continued on with their plans for the day, and they went on over to the Paxtons to pick passion fruit as planned. So Dean, the older brother, actually finished up a little bit earlier. So he went on home by himself. And then when Bradley and Daniel finished, they were driven home by the neighbor, Judith Paxton, on their farm quad bike. And then following this, Judith paid the boys and Daniel got his pay, which was $90. I was like, damn, that's a lot of money back then, right? Like $90. How long did it take them? Like a couple hours? It's good pay. Earlier that morning, Daniel had told his parents that he wanted to head on over to the mall, Sunshine Plaza, to buy Christmas presents for the family. He told them he was going to catch the bus there and then come home straight after. And his parents were okay with these plans because Daniel had caught a bus to and from this location at least 15 times prior. So once they returned home from picking passion fruit, Daniel asks his older brother, Dean, to come with him to Sunshine Plaza. But Dean was like, no, he wasn't down. So he hops in the shower and then Daniel makes his way to Sunshine Plaza. So this was at around 1 p.m. when Daniel left, and he left wearing a red Billabong t-shirt, a pair of dark colored shorts, a pair of Globe sneakers. He had his wallet with $100 cash inside. He had his Commonwealth bank card. He had his student card, a video card, and a phone card. So Daniel left his home and walked the 1.3 kilometers under a mile to the Nambour Connection Road near the Keel Mountain Road overpass. And this was under like a bridge area, and this wasn't an official bus stop, but it was a common meeting point for local residents waiting for buses, and buses knew to stop there to pick up passengers. So Daniel arrives at this unofficial bus stop, and the bus is due to arrive at 1:30 p.m. It's 1:35 p.m. and the bus doesn't arrive. So initially, Daniel was waiting for the bus by himself, but when the bus didn't arrive, a tall, skinny guy with dark brown hair, he comes from like a nearby church parking lot and then joins Daniel in the wait for the bus. Now, the bus was pretty late, so Daniel, he picks up a stick and he starts drawing in the dirt with it. Close to 2 p.m., the bus finally arrives and Daniel's like, oh my God. So he starts waving the bus down to let him know to pick him up. But it was clear that the bus was not going to stop. The bus now had changed routes because it was running so late, it was now running express. So the driver starts signaling to Daniel and this tall guy, saying, don't worry, like the next bus is coming soon. But it's believed that Daniel was quite annoyed about the bus, you know, being late and then not picking him up. So he possibly didn't see the bus driver letting him know the next bus was coming shortly. So the bus driver, he picks up his radio and he contacts the second bus driver and he lets him know that a man and a boy were waiting. So please make sure to pick them up because, again, this wasn't an official bus stop. Now, it took no more than a couple minutes for the second bus to arrive. But when the bus got there, the driver found no one waiting, so he left. So Bruce and Denise, they come home and they find Daniel wasn't home yet. And the boys knew that they had to be on the last bus home at the very latest. And the last bus was 5 p.m., which would arrive at that overpass bus stop at about 5:30 p.m. So his parents drove to the bus stop and waited there to pick up Daniel at about 4:30 p.m. So the bus arrives, but Daniel did not get off the bus. So the bus came every hour on Sundays. So his parents drove back home and then his dad, Bruce, came back an hour later to pick up Daniel. So at 5:30 p.m., Bruce arrives at the bus stop, which is around the time the last bus would arrive. And he looked for Daniel at the bus stop, or at least walking nearby, walking back home, but no sign of Daniel. Daniel was reliable. He never caused any trouble. So they thought, you know, maybe something happened. Maybe he didn't have enough money for the bus to come back home. Maybe he got hurt. So his parents drove down to Sunshine Plaza. They went to the bus depot. They called the bus company. They even hopped on another bus looking for Daniel, but no sign of him. And at this point, they knew something was wrong. By 7 p.m., so that's what, an hour and a half later, they walk into the Maroochydore police station to report their son Daniel missing. Sergeant Robbie Munn was the one who took his parents' report about Daniel. And he noticed that the parents were frantic, you know, about the fact that their son hadn't come home as yet. He was not the type to run away. He was not the type to cause any trouble. And Daniel knew that if he was running late, he would call his parents with the phone card that they had given him. Sergeant Robbie asked, you know, did anything happen at home? Did any fight take place? Any reason for him to run away? And his parents said, no. Everything was fine. There were no arguments. He was actually on his way to go buy presents for the family. He was fine mentally. This was just not like him. Sergeant Robbie tells them to relax. You know, he's most likely going to be home soon, so just go back home and wait. He tells them that, you know, he's going to check on them a little bit later. And at 10 p.m., when his shift ended, he did call the family and say, you know, what's the update? And by that point, his parents obviously did not just sit at home. They went on foot looking for Daniel. They contacted everyone they knew to see if they had seen or heard from Daniel. And no one had. Then at about 11 p.m., another police officer calls up Denise and Bruce and says to them, okay, well, you know, Daniel's not home as yet. So tomorrow morning when the Palmwoods police station opens up, you can make an official missing person report. Bruce and Denise were like, okay, but they felt that the police was not taking this seriously. I mean, considering he was so young, you would have thought that like some sort of search would have taken place, no? So the family obviously had a sleepless, restless night, you know, wondering where Daniel could be. And at about 4:30 a.m., they get up, they go looking for Daniel again on foot, and then they make that official missing persons report. After this, the police then go out searching for Daniel. Over 100 police officers search for Daniel in cane fields, waterways, backyards. Public appeals were made for witnesses to come forward. They began scouring hours of CCTV footage from the Sunshine Plaza Mall. They kept an eye on Daniel's bank account. They interviewed known sex offenders in the area. They put up a mannequin wearing the same clothes as Daniel in the area he was last seen, hoping to jolt people's memories, people that had been driving, you know, in that area that day. After receiving numerous tips, collecting eyewitness statements, investigators made several important discoveries in relation to Daniel's disappearance. Now, witnesses do remember seeing a young boy matching Daniel's description waiting at that bus stop that day. Passing motorists came forward to the police, letting them know that they had seen a blue car and a white van waiting near the bus stop on that day. Some said they had seen a blue car with one or two men inside talking to Daniel. Some said they spotted a blue car parked nearby with one or two men inside and they were talking to Daniel. Some said three men. Most had seen a young boy being manhandled into a vehicle. And it's hard because they had to rely on witness accounts. Like, there were no mobile phones or cameras back then to capture any evidence. And not sure why nobody reported a child being manhandled into a car, but hindsight is 2020, right? So enough people described this car to be a blue boxy sedan. So the police set up an investigation room called the Blue Car Room, where 37 photographs of boxy blue sedans were pasted all over the walls for witnesses to pick out from. A major incident room was set up, and within 72 hours of Daniel's disappearance, the police set up Operation Vista. And this investigation would become the biggest in Queensland's history. Police knocked on the door of 870 homes. Despite an extensive search, this in-depth investigation, the search for Daniel just came up empty. His family could not believe what happened. They searched for answers, but unfortunately, their search would go on for 8 long years. Over the years, the police did end up working pretty tirelessly over this case. They interviewed over 10,000 people during those years. A year after Daniel went missing, his family held a memorial for him where over 1,000 people attended. In 2008, a $1 million reward was offered for any information, but this was also unsuccessful. What's crazy is that I remember the time that this happened. Our school gave these talks on how to be safe when you're alone. And me and my friends, we would literally walk everywhere alone together. We would catch public transport alone. And like a lot of stuff happened to me on public transport. Like when I think about it, I'm like, how did nothing bad ever happen to me? I mean, it did, but like nothing bad, you know? And I feel like nowadays we can't do that. We can't send our kids on public transport with this confidence that most things are going to be okay. And like, we didn't have the technology we had these days to like call for help and be like, oh my God, you know, someone's following me. And it's just wild that may never be a thing in the coming years. Like kids in my area, kids are always walked with their parents, you know, they're dropped off. Some kids ride bikes and stuff alone, but it's in such a busy area that you would hope nothing kind of happens. But my kids ain't going anywhere alone. And that's actually sad because I feel like I had so many experiences, good and bad, being so independent, and kids in the future will, you know, maybe not have that. Prior to Daniel's disappearance, the Queensland District Intelligence Office set up Operation Butcher. Now, this was an investigation designed to identify pedophiles in the area. So after Daniel went missing, Operation Butcher sent a list of known sex offenders in the area to Operation Vista. Then each pedophile was placed on a job log and interviewed. On this list was a truck driver by the name of Brett Peter Cohen, and he was high on the police's list of suspects. So let's talk a little bit about Brett. Brett Peter Cohen was born on September 18th, 1969 in Western Australia. And he was born into a troubled family life filled with neglect and abuse. From a young age, Brett displayed behavioral problems, and he was known to the police for various offenses like theft and sexual misconduct. Throughout his life, Brett struggled with substance abuse issues. He struggled to maintain a stable job, stable relationships. His predatory tendencies manifested early on with numerous police encounters for sexually related offenses. So, trigger warning, I'm going to read you some of his offenses. So, in 1987, Brett had lured a 7-year-old boy into a park bathroom cubicle and raped him. He served just 1 year in prison for this crime. Then in 1993, Brett raped a 6-year-old boy in an abandoned car yard. This boy, he was left in an abandoned car in the bush with a punctured lung due to the force of the act and several cuts on his body. Now, luckily, this boy, I don't know how he got out of this car, but he got out and he stumbled into a petrol station where he received help. For this crime, Brett was sentenced to 3.5 years behind bars, and he was released in 1997. So when he was released in 1997, he was a changed man. He became a reformed Christian. He attended church. He got married and had a couple children of his own. After 2003, Brett stopped attending church and divorced his wife in 2004. He then signed up for a few gay dating websites under fake names and looked for extreme sex acts on these websites. I'm sorry if I sound frustrated and annoyed. I just didn't think that this was going to upset me as much as it is. Sometimes I wonder, like, why am I doing this if I'm so emotional, like such an emotional person, so dumb. Anyway, so when Brett was first interviewed by the police, he tells the police, yeah, I drove past that bus stop. I was on my way to get some marijuana from my drug dealer and I noticed Daniel standing there alone. He then admits that, yep, he stopped near Daniel and offered him a ride. But when Daniel turned him down, he just kept on going. Brett's wife was also interviewed, and it was later discovered that she had in fact lied to the police about where Brett was on the day that Daniel disappeared. She later admitted that he had in fact disappeared as well for around 5 hours on December 7th. Then in July 2009, Bruce and Denise called for a coronial inquest into Daniel's disappearance. This was granted, and this coronial inquest was held between the months of October 2010 and April 2011. So there were several witnesses called, and some of them were the bus driver who had failed to stop for Daniel at the overpass, a woman who had seen a man loitering near Daniel, and several other persons of interest. During this inquest, Bruce finally stated that he felt that the police didn't take the disappearance of his son seriously. They waited over 24 hours before making any action. Many witnesses were called to testify, including sex offenders in the area. A female witness who was on the bus that passed Daniel stated that she had seen Daniel waiting for the bus, and she called out the bus driver for not stopping and picking him up. Another witness said that she had also seen Daniel waiting at the bus stop playing with a stick in the dirt, and that she saw another man standing behind him with one foot up on the wall. Another witness said that she had seen Daniel as well, but he was dressed so neatly, and the other passenger that was near Daniel was dressed really scruffy, so she didn't think they were related. Then in April 2011, the last witness to give any evidence was known as P7. P7 was a sex offender and stated that he had nothing to do with Daniel's disappearance. P7 was Brett Cohen. After the inquest, Brett was due to fly back home to Perth. Now, Brett was always high on the police's list of suspects, but they had no real evidence to hold him by. They were unable to pursue a case against Brett with what evidence? But they did come up with an idea to get more information out of Brett. Now, guys, this is where this case just gets so interesting. You're going to want to clap for the police after this because it's just so good. So anyway, Brett was due to fly home that day, right? So on his flight back home, he meets a guy that's sitting next to him, a passenger, by the name of Joe Emery. Now, Brett did not know Joe, but soon as they began chatting, Brett finds out that Joe is part of a gang. He's moving to Perth and he needs to purchase a car. Brett offered to help, and when they landed in Perth, the next day, Brett takes Joe, shows him around Perth, and takes him to a car dealership. Joe buys a car, and as Brett and Joe keep chatting, Brett tells Joe that he has recently lost his job, and Joe offered him one and offered to introduce him to other gang members. One was known as Fitzy. Now, Fitzy was the boss of this gang, and it's crazy to me how people just like get into relations with gangs, but I guess Brett needed money and he was used to doing bad things. So anyway, so he was given small jobs because the gang had to make sure that they could trust this guy because, again, the gang doesn't know Brett. So he would assist in small jobs, and eventually his involvement increased in the gang as he earned the trust and respect of other gang members. He was now being paid and he was happy to be part of this little gang. I think it really got to his head. Like, he finally felt maybe important. Then Brett was introduced to the big, big boss. Like, this is months later. And the big, big boss's name is Arnold. But when Arnold is introduced to Brett, he soon hears about his possible involvement in the Daniel Morcombe case. So in August 2011, Arnold meets with Brett one-on-one alone. And in this meeting, he tells him, look, I need to tie up loose ends. Like, the gang doesn't need police coming and sniffing around. This is what he tells Brett. Is there something you need to tell me? Bearing in mind, what we do is based on respect and honesty. I don't care what you've done. I got no qualms at all. I've had a lot of real bad guys on my books. What they do doesn't faze me at all. All I'm looking for is loyalty, respect, and honesty. Now, at the time, the gang had a really big job coming up, a job that would pay Brett very well, $100,000. Now, the work that Brett did in this gang was easy for Brett. He would transport illegal guns, illegal goods, blackmail people. They would do some debt collection. And he was getting paid really well for this. He was in this gang. He had respect. He had friends, you know? He couldn't lose this. But when Arnold, the boss, comes to him and lets him know, hey, let me know what you've done because I have word that you're, you know, involved in this Daniel Morcombe case, Brett at first denies any involvement. Then Arnold tells Brett, one of the gang members is a dirty cop. Through this cop, Arnold has an email from inside the police investigation talking about all the holes in Brett's alibi, how the police believe that Brett is responsible for Daniel's murder. Arnold tells him, look, we can't have the police, you know, coming around and investigating the gang. We have this massive deal coming up. I mean, if Brett was going to get paid $100,000, He's one of the members. Imagine how big the deal is. Imagine how much money the boss, Arnold, was going to make off this deal. So he didn't want cops coming around. And he was like, Brett, you've done good work. Fitzy, Joe has told me you're valuable to this team. And if you're not going to tell me the truth, I can't help you. And I will help you. If you tell me what happened, I will help you sort out this mess. And that alone is so messed up. He actually says to him, I don't care what you've done. I don't care if you did murder Daniel, a 13-year-old boy. He doesn't care. And that alone is so sick. But with all of that, Brett comes clean. Brett starts telling him all about what happened, what he did to Daniel, where the body was, etc. Now, what Brett didn't know was that this entire conversation was being recorded. And what else he didn't know was that this entire criminal gang was fake. Joe was fake. Fitzy was fake. Arnold was fake. They were all undercover members of the Australian Federal Police, a 35-man fictional crime gang.
Honesty, trust, respect, all right?
Yeah, okay. No, yeah, I did it.
All right, so, okay, so you hit it, but what I'm saying is, you know, I need to kind of go, I need to step you right back to the whole thing.
I mean, that blew my mind. For months, they were just leading Brett on. They built his trust. They convinced him he was committing crimes when in reality, he wasn't. All the illegal operations he was undertaking, all the, you know, people he was shaking down, it was all fake. They were all acting. And this was all part of a sting operation called Mr. Big that the police began in April 2011. After Brett spilled all the details, Arnold's like, okay, all right, we got you. Let's sort this out. So he tells Brett, you know, lead me to where you've buried the body under the guise of, you know, we need to make sure there are no remains that can be found by the police. And there's video footage of this. So they take Brett, or Brett takes Arnold to the area where he buried Daniel. And once they're there and he's showing him, Arnold revealed his identity. Police were waiting in the bushes. It was all being filmed.
Police! Stay there, Brett.
Stay there, mate.
Stay where you are. Stay where you are. Stay where you are. Police.
Just to tell them that I'm under arrest, am I?
Not at this time. If you're happy to remain with us and speak with us in relation to this matter.
You just can arrest me.
All right, you're under arrest for the murder of Daniel Morcombe.
Yep, cool. I'm under arrest for Daniel Morcombe's murder.
Brett Peter Cohen was then placed under arrest for the murder of Daniel Morcombe. So what the hell did he do to Daniel? And I don't even want to talk about this. So on that day, Brett was driving past the Nambour Connection Road where Daniel was waiting for a bus. He first drives past the broken down bus, and then as he keeps driving, he sees Daniel waiting for the bus by himself. And he says he couldn't help himself. Once he drove past Daniel in his white Mitsubishi Pajero, he then drives to the nearby church, leaves his car in the church parking lot, and then walks on over to the bus stop. He began talking to Daniel, began offering him a lift to Sunshine Plaza Mall, and eventually, once the bus was late, the bus drove past, he persuaded Daniel to go with him. Once Daniel got into his car, instead of driving him to the Sunshine Plaza, he drives him to a secluded house. When he gets inside the house, he apparently attempted to molest Daniel inside the house, and his plan was only to rape the boy and then drop him back to the bus stop. But when Daniel fought back, Brett panicked and grabbed him around the throat, strangling him to death. And He said he never ended up molesting him. He just panicked. And that's what caused Daniel's death. And this information he had given to the police. And this did not match up with the story he had told the gang leader, Arnold. And I'm assuming he changed his story because he didn't know that that conversation with Arnold was being recorded. So I'm sorry, trigger warning again, because I'm going to talk about what Brett said he actually did to Daniel when he was talking to Arnold. And I'm giving a trigger warning because I just want to scream. So Brett told Arnold that when he saw Daniel, that Daniel was a f***ing cute little thing. And he then tells Arnold that he'd had his man fun 4 other times in that abandoned house where he took Daniel. He said when he arrived at the house, he went inside. And I'm assuming Daniel stayed in the car at this point. And he kind of comes back out of the house and he goes, my missus asked if you wanted a drink before heading on to the plaza. Now, Daniel, being young, unsuspecting, being a teenager, went inside the house. When Daniel got inside, Brett tried to pull his pants down, but Daniel tried to run, and that's when Brett panicked and grabbed him. He told Arnold that he knew if Daniel got away, that he was fucked. He said, if he didn't want to run, I would have had my fun with him, and I would have taken him back to near where I got him and dropped him off. You know, because it's Daniel's fault, you know, just let him have some fun. Stupid idiot. He allegedly grabbed Daniel by the crook of his arm and choked him. 10 to 15 minutes later, Brett was back in his car driving home. He left Daniel's body covered in branches nearby, near an old sand mine. A week later, he returned with a shovel to bury the body, but all the bones were gone. He told Arnold that he used a shovel to crush up a fragment that was left of Daniel's skull. On 21st August 2011, 2 shoes and 3 human bones were found. These shoes were similar to the ones Daniel was wearing. Then, later on, underpants and a belt were also found, and by the end of the investigation, 17 bones had been found, including a rib, a hip, leg bone, arm, and vertebrae. These were all confirmed as belonging to Daniel. They matched it using DNA from his toothbrush. Forensic evidence indicated that Daniel had suffered significant trauma consistent with assault, confirming the brutal nature of the crime. Daniel's family finally had answers. Bittersweet closure. Daniel's funeral was held at Siena Catholic College on 7th December 2012, and more than 2,000 people attended it. His funeral was held on the exact day that he disappeared, and imagine that day, December 7th, 2003. His parents would have never known that they were going to be burying their son on that exact day, 9 years later. Ugh. Brett Cohen's trial commenced in February 2014, and the prosecution prevented damning evidence linking him to the murder of Daniel, including DNA samples and witness testimonies. Justice Rosalind Atkinson described his crime as entirely abhorrent, and she made a pretty powerful statement. She stated, "You didn't look like a monster. You didn't look like a pedophile. You looked like an ordinary person. You knew if he ran away, you'd be caught. So you killed him. You killed him because you didn't want to get caught. Everything you did to that boy is horrific and disgraceful. I've seen no evidence in the months you've been in this court that you've ever felt any remorse for what you did. You have tragically and pointlessly snuffed out a young life." Despite Brett's attempts to discredit the evidence, fabricate an alibi, the jury returned a guilty verdict, sentencing him to life imprisonment with a non-parole period of 20 years. Justice Rosalind stated that she did not believe he should ever be granted parole, And I feel like when a judge says that, that hopefully has some more weight than, you know, the victim's family or other people in the community not wanting this person to get parole. His family, you know, was happy with the conviction and the closure it brought to their unending nightmare at that point. But the pain of losing Daniel was gonna linger indefinitely. His father, Bruce, read in a statement, 10 years ago, you made a choice that ripped our family apart. You have robbed Daniel of 70 years of life. I often wonder about the other victims you have left in your wake. Sitting in the same room as you revolts me. Daniel's twin brother, Bradley, made a statement saying, for me, there is not a single day that I don't think about Daniel. I know Daniel is still with me in my heart and in my thoughts, and he always will be. While I had known about this case, I read many quick articles on it over the years. Actually researching it, reliving the details, it got me. Like, I cried so many times during my research, you know, thinking about what poor Daniel went through, what those other two poor boys, Brett's victims, went through. I found out that Brett ended up having a son, you know, and he was clearly a pedophile into young boys. And while I know that there's a chance that Brett himself was molested and learned this behavior, I don't care. The pure evil that Brett is, the scars he has left on multiple families, his victims, is infuriating and disgusting. He is not remorseful. Did you see him being arrested? He does not give a shit. Bruce and Denise suffered for nearly a decade. His brothers suffered for nearly a decade. Children are special. Our children are special. They are our lives. And people like Brett Cohen feel like they can just do whatever they want to whomever they want. And one amazing fact is that the people in prison with Brett, other criminals, feel the same. While in prison, Brett was attacked by another inmate. Boiling water was poured all over Brett, leaving him with severe burns. I'm sure we can all agree to turn a blind eye to that. The Mr. Big operation ran by the police is truly amazing. If they didn't do that, would Brett have ever been caught? I'm a big fan of Mr. Big sting operations, and I guess the concern there would be false confessions being made, but this whole sting was just perfect. It would not have been easy for all 35 police officers acting undercover without wanting to punch Brett in the face. So we always talk about bad police work. I mean, let's talk about how good the police did in this situation, and if only they acted a bit earlier. Now, Daniel's parents have started the Morcombe Foundation, and they have some incredible information on this site, like resources about educating children, about body safety, about making Australia a safer place for kids, preventing abuse and risk of harm. And I will leave it linked below. If you have kids, I highly recommend you check it out. It doesn't have to be, you know, only Australians. Again, this case really, really got me. It physically hurt me. It hurt my soul. And I pray for Daniel's family and any other families out there whose children have been taken away at the hands of a monster. When you research and delve deep into cases like this, you know, you wish you could do something about it. I wish I could prevent this from ever happening to another child, but I know I can't. But what I can do is share these stories and bring awareness. Let's keep our kids safe, guys. Let me know your thoughts down in the comments below, guys. And I will see you in next week's video. Besitos. Bye.